Hello, I'm Greg Johnston. Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2023 season. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a breathtaking $100,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. Robin Cadwallader has published three novels, The Anchoress, Book of Colours, which won the 2019 ACT Book of the Year Award, and her latest novel, The Fire and the Rose. The novels are all set in medieval England and are tantalisingly linked and pose great challenges in research and writing. It's a great pleasure to welcome Robin Cadwallader to Imagining the Past.
Thank you for having me, Greg.
You had an academic career before you published The Anchoress. I'm just wondering what inspired the shift to creative writing.
Oh, well, I'd always wanted to write creatively. And when I left uni, when I went to uni from high school, there was really no option for classes in creative writing. So I did a standard bachelor in English, and that basically I just got interested in medieval literature and did a little bit of writing tinkering on the side, but didn't do very much, and I went into, I did a PhD, started teaching, you know, those things kind of just take over as that's how you earn a living. But I kept writing poetry along the way. And it was really being caught in a sandwich of university politics that made me leave university and decide that I had really been damaged enough. I wouldn't do any more. And that was, the timing was perfect. Our children had basically moved out of home, so we could afford for me not to work. And I thought, well, you don't want to die wondering. So I started writing this novel that had been in my head all the time I was doing the PhD, thinking, I really don't want to write an argument, a very long 100,000 word argument, which is what the PhD had to be. I really want to write something creative. And that was the perfect opportunity to do it.
So your writing career was born out of the slings and arrows of academia.
Yes. I don't thank them for it. But it you know, they say the best revenge is something. Success, is it? But it's been very nice to know that the people in the department who really helped facilitate the sandwich that I got stuck in could see me being published, doing reasonably well. So,
So what was the first hint or interest you had in The Fire and the Rose? How did that come about?
Oh, that just began because I noticed as I was reading, doing some research, I think it was for Book of Colours, I discovered, just read a sentence about when the Jews were expelled in 1290, and I had never heard about that, and I had done a fair bit of reading and research in the medieval period, and I was horrified at the thought of Jews being, or any people being, just summarily told to leave the country. And I read a little bit more and it stayed in my mind. I was just horrified. And I think at the time there was so much going on in the world about people being forced out of their homeland for various reasons, refugees and whatever. And I had been working, editing a book about asylum seekers trying to come to Australia and being treated so badly. All those things kind of coalesced, really, and I couldn't get that out of my head. I knew that writing it would be ambitious and a bit sensitive, so I had to be, I thought pretty carefully about it before I began. Did I have the right to write about Jewish people? Those kinds of questions. And I knew I would need to do a lot of research about the minutiae of the history, which was fairly complicated. But I'd also had in my mind, ever since I'd finished The Anchoress, that Eleanor's the little girl in The Anchoress who learns to read and write. And I had always wondered how she would manage in a village, being able to read and write, and would the village suddenly seem really restricted and contained. And she's such a the sort of kid who won't take no for an answer. And in a way, it sort of felt like she'd like a novel of her own, thank you. So the two of them came together, and she gave me a way into writing the history. So I knew I had an interesting character there, and she could help me find my way into writing about the history.
Yeah, that's a lovely resonance of our present situation in an historical situation, which is essentially 900 years ago or more.
Yes.
So I think that's something I really enjoy in historical fiction, is finding those resonances to the present day.
To the present, yeah.
So you've kind of hinted at this kind of mingling of the characters between The Anchoress and Book of Colours and The Fire and the Rose. Did you conceive the three novels in your wildest dream at the same time, or was that an evolution?
I'm absolutely not a planner about anything. And to be really honest, when my agent first spoke to me about The Anchoress, she said to me, "Have you got anything else in mind? Because as I send it out, publishers would like to know if you've got something else on the boil that that could come next." And I just grasped at the one thing that had been on my mind was my interest in illuminated manuscripts and the funny drawings all around the edges. So I said that, I'm, you know, working on a novel about, you know, which was only partly true. So that's how Book of Colours came about. And I wanted to continue on. There's in The Anchoress, there's a Psalter, a Book of Psalms that Eleanor discovers that's burnt. And I wanted to link that in with Book of Colours, where Eleanor has it and passes it on to her daughter, and one of the illuminators in Book of Colours is inspired to take up painting because of it. Yeah, and then this novel, The Fire and the Rose, goes back in time a little bit, back to Eleanor. They're not chronological in chronological order. They're just as the ideas came up to me.
Yeah, well, they mingle together quite.
Yeah, they have their links.
The Anchoress and Book of Colours are structurally kind of complex. There's different points of view and time periods. The Fire and the Rose uses only one third person point of view and a continuous time period. I'm just wondering what some of your decisions were around making those selections in all the books, you know, the how you thought about point of view and the time chronologies.
That's an interesting question. In the Anchoress, I began writing in third person. No, I began writing in first person and then thought perhaps I should try third person. I wasn't sure that I wanted to do it in first person, but it took only a couple of chapters of writing in third person to realise that no, actually I did need to go back to first person to create that sense of not so much claustrophobia, but the interiorness of the cell. But then I realised also that I needed to think about my reader not getting too overwhelmed by that idea of being caught inside four walls. So I decided that I wanted to have the world come to Sarah, the anchoress, from outside, but I and limit how much of the outside that I showed. But I felt that her confessor would be a way to move outside the cell in a limited way. So that's why I chose the second narrative thread, which is the confessor who speaks from third person point of view. I tell his story from third person point of view. So I felt that gave the right balance. With Book of Colours, it was a little more complicated, but I wanted to play with the idea that of the distance between the woman who was asking for this book to be made for her and the illuminators who were making it. So I wanted the woman with the book to have it and to be looking at it and reflecting on it and reflecting on the people who had made it while it was being made in a second narrative thread. And then there's a point where they kind of come together. So it made for a relatively complex kind of structure. And I'm not sure. I know some people have found it very difficult to follow, but I wanted to do a little bit more than just say this is how you write a book and this is who it's illustrate a book and this is who it's for. I wanted to reflect on the idea that particularly for the women, Gemma, who's helping to illustrate the book, and Matilda, the woman who's having it painted for her, are both struggling with the limitations of their situation, but in quite different ways. And in many ways, they're unaware of each other and unaware of the of what they have to do in order to fulfill their lives as much as they can. And The Fire and the Rose, my publisher suggested that I start at the expulsion. And I tried that. She wanted to make sure that I kept enough energy and pace in it. So she suggested I start sort of at the end. So I tried that with some flashbacks, but it was just impossible. There was too much history and too much development to be able to do that. So I thought, I'll just start at the beginning and see what happens. And I did have, what is it? It's a span of 14 years or something across from 1276 to 1290.
90, yeah.
Yeah.
14 years.
So I had that gap and that in itself, working out how to tell a story across that length of time was actually quite a challenge because I'd never done that before.
It did feel like you had set yourself a challenge in a way of restricting the point of view down rather than having this multicolored palette at your disposal. You had kind of restricted it down and were working with it with that.
Well, yeah, I wanted to focus very much on the relationship between Eleanor and Asher, and let the history, to fill out the history around them via them, because I didn't want to fall into the trap of paragraphs of this is what was happening, the king was saying this, the sheriff was saying that. I wanted it to be very much the Jewish Christian experience of the expulsion and the prejudice.
Yeah, but also choosing a character who was non-Jewish, I think, allowed you, your character, to be slightly ingenue about the whole thing. And so it gave you a narrative device to explain things, because Eleanor had to discover these things as it was progressing.
Exactly, yeah.
There's also a lot of the chapters seem a lot shorter to me in this novel. The others, seem much more expansive. So that seemed a deliberate strategy. So I'm just kind of wondering if it was and to what end you deployed it.
No, it wasn't deliberate. I'm to be honest, I'm never entirely sure what a chapter's shape is. I just basically just told the story, and when it felt like there was the action had kind of had developed its own shape with a beginning, middle, and an end, I stopped. So no, it wasn't a strategy. I'd like to say it was, but no.
One of the novel's concerns is the death of little Hugh and the abuse by the Catholic Church of this story. Had there been antecedents to this story of little Hugh? Had there been other kind of similar stories?
Yes, yeah. The blood libel, it was called, there were stories in France and Germany, I think, and in London, and the claims were that Jews had been kidnapping little boys and torturing them and draining their blood, crucifying them in rituals, in their Jewish rituals. It was all part of a kind of, pretty weird sense of what goes on in the synagogues. Mm. This was one of them. There were some others in England as well. But I think that Hugh is the one that stood out to me because he was made a saint. He wasn't made a saint. He was called a saint. Mm. He was buried in the cathedral, and he had pilgrims came to his crypt to pray and to donate money. It's very easy to imagine. Who knows the details of the history, but it's very easy to imagine that the disappearance of an eight-year-old boy might get the minds of the cathedral hierarchy thinking here's an opportunity.
It's very very manipulative. The crimes are alleged to have happened against little Hugh. There would have been quite visible signs of this on his body. Are there any records of when his body was found of these marks on his body, or is that all fabulated as well?
No, there aren't. The records, what we have is, I think it's about four accounts by monks who tell the story, and there are scholars who've gone through and tried to ascertain how accurate those accounts are, and it's quite difficult to tell. So there's no document that, you know, at the time that the sheriff didn't arrive and make a report or anything like that. So what we do have is trying to put together the four accounts and make some sense of them. And it seems that the body was found in a well, but it's hard to know how long the body had been in the well, because it was one in a well in the city, apparently behind the castle. So he can't have been there very long. So who knows? Yeah, there's really nothing to say for sure.
It's almost biblical, isn't it? Four accounts and you're trying.
Well, yeah, I was thinking together. That, yes. This synoptic monk accounts, yeah. But they all had, you know, a couple of them are just appalling, because they are so damning of the Jews and actually go to extremes about the horrors. And it's just, it's an appalling story.
Weren't you at one point, I remember when you were in the beginning of writing it, I think you were thinking about actually telling the story of Little Hugh as well? In a more detailed kind of narrativized.
Yeah, yes. Well, it went through quite a few shifts, and I actually still, I suppose I do. I feel this way with all everything I've written, that I never feel like I've quite done justice to the material, and I. The story of Hugh is one where I feel like perhaps I could have done a better job. I really wanted to tell that story, but I also I didn't want that to overwhelm the rest of the story. And Eleanor, this is really Eleanor's story. And so the story of Hugh had to come within her orbit. And I had at one stage had the walls tell the story of Little Hugh, and I wrote it in medieval alliterative verse, and I spent a lot of time telling that story in between the chapters, it would just be woven in here and there through in between chapters. And look, they were quite good verses, but every time I read through the manuscript, I just thought, this is just not working. They're too heavy. And I tinkered and tinkered until the day that I said, look, they're just not working. You just have to accept it. It was as if the story didn't have any space to breathe.
Yeah.
There was this terrible story of Hugh and the terrible story of the Jews, and it felt dense and just clogged up.
True, because the main story of Eleanor is 21 years after the discovery of the body. So, you know, I think by her again being this outsider who's come into the village, so not only is she discovering, you know, Jewish people, but she's discovering this story and what happened. So it does, it works. I think it works a lot better to have it like that. Presumably in that epoch, a lot of children went missing. What's known about Little Hugh, and why did his disappearance and discovery matter so much?
Yeah, I think the disappearance of Hugh and the fact that so much attention was paid to it makes sense when you understand the context of the number of stories of ritual killings of of young boys that had developed in England from the mid-1100s to around 1255, there had been five stories about little boys being ritually killed by Jews, in some cases that they were described as having been crucified to spite Christ and his crucifixion, and in other cases they were described as having their blood drained and the blood used for rituals, which were kind of mockery of the sacraments, the Eucharistic sacraments. So those stories were around at the time, and in all cases it was the Jews who were accused of having killed these little boys. So I think that when a boy goes missing in a city where there are Jews, because at that point there weren't Jews. Jews weren't allowed to live in every city. They were only allowed to live in some of the major cities in England. The king wanted to limit where they were allowed to live, partly for their security, but also in order to maintain better control of money lending and contracts. So if you think about it, there are shrines in England and there are stories in Europe about little boys being captured by Jews for their purposes, these ritual murders. And you're in a city where there are Jews and there's already bad feeling between the Christians and the Jews. I don't think it makes sense, really, that it could have Christians begin to say, this is another case. Even if it was a boy who didn't matter much, I think the power of story is, and the power of that kind of malicious story is able to sort of latch on to the story of to just hearing about a little boy going missing. And they just begin to attach blame to various Jews in the town. It's interesting that the Prioress's Tale by Chaucer is the story of a little boy who is killed by the Jews, has his throat slit, and he's left in a gutter. But he keeps singing, and he's taken to the church where he keeps singing, and a seed needs to be taken from his mouth in order for him to stop singing so that he can be buried. And then Chaucer adds, or the prioress at the end of her tale adds, and of course you will have all heard the story of little Hugh, and briefly describes how he was killed by Jews. And that's 135 years after the story of little Hugh in 1255. So, and The Jew of Malta by Marlowe in the early 18th century, that story is still being told then. So it has this amazing power to grab the minds of people who want to use it. I think that says quite a bit about the power of the story of a little boy being taken and tortured. The only fact in there is that that we know is that we have the crypt, and we know the king visited Lincoln at a certain date, and that John of Lexington, who was the one who interrogated Copen, the man who was accused of actually killing him, we know that he was there, and we know that the king came, but there's very little else has any fact attached to it. You know, where he was found. At one stage, apparently, it was said that he was found in the well in a Jew's house. But in the 1900s, it was discovered that, in the 1900s, that a man had built it in something like 1926, I think, in order to sort of give the house some kind of heritage value. So there's very little about the whole story that has history. There's a lot about it that has story and, and accretions of other myths.
But what does this tell us, do you think, about the process of myth making that over 21 years, you know, this story of little Hugh had just been contorted and used to political ends and financial ends? What does that tell us? Like, I'm interested in that, particularly in relation to, you know, the life of Christ, which wasn't written down till 300 years after the events. So this whole process of myth making is very active and it's contorted by people.
Yes. Yeah. My strongest sense of the story of Hugh was that that it, whatever was said, it would haunt the city, and it would be the perfect opportunity whenever there was any claim against the Jews, it would be, you know, you were the people who killed that poor little boy. So that story becomes, you know, like you, as you say, myth, becomes a kind of just a resonance that hangs in the town and can be used and abused. The other horrific thing is that the story remained for hundreds of years, and in the cathedral, the little plaque next to the crypt had said that this is the body of little Hugh, who was murdered by the wicked Jews, and there's a bit of a description, and that even when they established that the Jews, that story had no basis in fact, that plaque remained there until something like the 1960s.
Wow.
So they really, the church had allowed that myth to continue until they finally have replaced it with a plaque that apologises and says that there's no basis in it.
Why let the truth get in the way of a good story?
The story, well, exactly, exactly, yes.
So a lot of things in the novel do happen off screen. The actual birth of Eleanor's daughter Hannah and her parting with Asher are not really addressed directly. I'm just wondering what your strategy was around that.
I wrote a birth scene and wondered whether I should keep it, but I don't know. Can you call it writerly instinct? It wasn't so much deliberate. I think there was a sense that I wanted to, because it's in four parts, and the first part finishes with Eleanor discovering she's pregnant and working out what she's going to do, and I wanted that to finish there. I think I wanted to then reestablish her in another place, in another life. So I didn't want to just sort of say, I didn't want to fall into saying and then the baby was born, then this happened, then that happened. I wanted to keep it moving a little bit more than that, I think.
I think often writers feel compelled to sketch in every detail, but it just reminds me of jazz music, where often if something's left out, there's a kind of hint of it, but it's left out and it's actually much more satisfying.
Yes. Well, as they say, you know, cut. The more you can cut, the better it will be. So
there's a limit, isn't there?
Yeah, but there is.
Three words.
Yep.
So as you've alluded to today, your research was clearly extensive and pretty broad ranging. Were there any standout moments in that for you? I always love those discoveries of something you've kind of been looking for.
Well, one of the standouts was, there are two that I could mention. One was going to Lincoln, and I knew that it was a city built on a hill, but actually going there and walking up and down that hill was pretty remarkable. Just thinking, these people walked up and down this hill all the time, and they would have had a horse to pull a cart, but they would have had to get all their goods up the top. The markets were up near the top of three quarters of the way up the hill, and at the top as well, and just the impact that would have made on their lives. I think that was it was important to kind of feel it myself, you know, feel the, you know, the puffing and the sore leg muscles. And the second thing was discovering that there's an episode where the king is suspicious that people are clipping coins, which means cutting the edges off coins and melting down. They were made of silver, melting down the silver and using it for, you know, selling it for other, with other things, made into other things, but also selling on these coins that were smaller than they should have been. And because he was suspicious about that, he sent two men around the country to basically, it was a kind of sting operation where they were, you know, talking to people about how they wanted to trade in silver, and were basically just trying to entice people into deals, and they could then accuse them of coin clipping. So that was an interesting bit of drama, the idea of these undercover agents working, even though people were a bit suspicious of them. But yeah, that was a bit of, you know, that could be a movie.
The sting.
yeah, absolutely.
I'm interested in one of the really strong female characters. You'll have to correct my pronunciation, but is it Marcotta?
Yeah, I think it's Marcotta. Yeah.
Who was married to Coppin, who was a man who was eventually confessed to the murder of Hugh, but under torture. How did you find out about her life after the crime? And, you know, that must have been quite difficult to find out about her.
Well, I made it all up.
Oh, okay.
what I do know is that it was actually from a just a single reference to that she and Copen lived in a particular house on Steep Hill, and they do have the records about who owned what house on Steep Hill, and then
is that house still there?
No. Yes, but yeah, there are a couple of houses. It's now a bit unclear, but there are two. One's called Jew's House, and it's a restaurant, and the other one is the Jewish Society have a bookshop. And that's where they think the synagogue was. But there's now a little bit of doubt about exactly which house this reference is to Copen and his wife, Marcotta. But there is evidence that she was there in the 1280s, sorry. So she had stayed on after he was killed. That's the one thing, that's the one piece of information I had. So I just ran with that. And how would it be? Why would you stay knowing that the city hated your husband, accused you of luring a boy to his death? Why would you stay, and what would it be like? And what kind of person would be capable of that? So her whole character really developed from that one piece of information. And just inferring, you know, in my mind what she would be like. And I she wears green because later there are quite a few stories about Little Hugh in folklore and in songs where a fairy dressed in green lures Little Hugh in and gives him an apple and then sticks him with a knife. And I thought, I wonder where that came from. Perhaps Marcotta wore green. So, and once I thought about that, and I put her in the first chapter as an unusual woman coming into the spices shop, meeting Eleanor wearing green. Once I got that scene, I had her a very strong sense of her kind of determination to hang in with her place, her city. You know, she wasn't going to be cowed by the city. And she knew the truth of her situation.
Well, she's almost standing as a testimony to that truth, isn't she, by saying yes. If she'd run, she would have supported the lies. One of the swoons when Antipodeans go to Europe is the presence of these old buildings and the continued use of them. The village I lived in had a massive Etruscan arch that we walked through every day uncaringly, really, like it was only occasionally I looked at it.
Yes.
But the poems in the book, The Walls Speak, they seem to at once, they're once a rupture but they to the text, but also somehow a kind of natural consequence of it. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about writing them and what was the process about writing and using them?
That's a nice description of them. A rupture and a consequence. That's kind of what I hope they would be. As I said, they began. My initial thought was when I went to Lincoln and saw the stone, and you know, it's a city with, obviously a lot has changed, but the old parts of the city still have stone on the. And the roads, there are stone houses, and I know that the medieval city was completely surrounded by stone walls, and there were more being built at the time of this story. So the cathedral was having walls built around the cathedral close where the clergy lived, as a way of protecting them from thugs at night who wanted to beat them up, which is interesting in itself, I think. So I was really struck that this was a city of stone. It felt very strongly like a city of stone covering this hill. And I thought to myself, what would these walls have witnessed? What would they have seen? And they would have stood there as kind of protection for people inside, but also a way of keeping people out. as well. And who knows where these ideas came from, but I knew that I wanted the stone to speak in some way. So I decided to make it the walls, because there's a nice resonance with both the Old and the New Testament speak about, you know, if we remain silent, even the walls would cry out, which was a nice allusion to both Christian and Jewish thought. And you know, we do use walls a lot. In the Holocaust Museum, there are walls, are part of the very strong part of the memorial.
Well, the Great Wall.
Yes, exactly. Yes, yeah. So I wanted all those things to kind of gather into that idea of the walls, and that's where I began. But then I got a bit distracted into writing them in a medieval way, and telling the story of Hugh. And I don't know quite how that happened, but it was like I just lost my direction for quite a long time, really, until quite near the end I just decided that I needed to change them. And I read a book called Stone, an eco-history, I think it's called, of stone, by a Jewish medievalist called Jeffrey Cohen. And I found that really exciting. He has quite different ways of thinking about stone as something more than dead, lifeless matter. But I also wanted some kind of philosophical frame for their voice. And I spoke to my daughter, who had done philosophy, and she suggested that I look at Emmanuel Levinas, who's a Jewish philosopher, and he writes a lot about the importance of the other. And it suddenly felt like, yep, it all came together, that they could write using some of his thoughts. And I actually, that would have been the most fun part of writing the whole novel, was that moment when I said, okay, I'm going to give them another voice, and I'm going to write quite differently from anything else. I'm just going to let loose.
The walls are modern, really, and you've got this very free verse form, which is ultra modern, so it's like the walls are talking in the present day.
Yes, well, I wanted them to have that capacity to be timeless, in a sense that they're not I wanted to take it out of the medieval setting and say, so I didn't want the reader to be able to think, oh, well, this is what happened in the 13th century. I wanted the walls to suggest this is what happens over and over and over again. So
they also felt like a bit of an extension of your animated grotesques in The Book of Colours, and even the art of the illumination in the book within Book of Colours. It felt like you had taken that kind of trope and used it again.
Yes, and actually, in the anchoress as well, Sarah says, you know, if these walls could speak, what would they say? So it is a kind of
link.
Well, yeah, and a fascination of mine about stone, and I think particularly old stone. You know, going to England and as you were talking about the Etruscan arch, you know, being in England, looking at standing stones and old ruins, and it just feels like they hold on to so much history. And that's my fascination, I think.
Well, they're also the hand of God and the hand of humanity, aren't they? In that, you know, humanity has taken an object that was made and redeployed it.
Yes.
They're kind of both. So I'm going to sound like your agent now, God forbid. What are you working on now?
Oh, it's not going to be medieval. I'm moving on. What can I say? I'm reading a little bit about space time and Einstein. I'm thinking about the island of Samothrake and an old sort of temple complex there, which is a ruin now, but was a temple to the great god, or the great gods, no one in particular. I'm thinking about mountain goats and ghosts. So make of that what you will. I don't know what I will make of it. It's just...
I'm thinking zing.
Who knows? I'm just taking it slowly and...
Of course.
And just, you know, pondering a few things. And it may come to nothing. I might end up doing something completely different. But at the moment, that's what I'm thinking about.
Yeah. I'm interested too in what was the first scene you wrote for The Fire and the Rose, and did it actually survive to the final edit?
Oh, I think the first scene would have been something about the expulsion, because I tried to start there. Oh, I think the first scene was a variation on the fire scene that's at the end of the novel. It's Eleanor running up the hill, smelling smoke, remembering her burned psalter, and realizing that documents, Jewish documents, were being burned. That didn't survive. Sort of the spirit of it did, but the detail didn't.
Yeah.
And it changed quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. It's interesting to start in such a what ends as the end, and kind of a bleak manner to the novel. So,
well, it was my attempt to follow my publisher's suggestion and start at the expulsion, and I thought this would happen right near the end. It was my attempt to start at the end, but you know, whenever I wrote sort of a bit of backstory tried to integrate backstory into it, I gave it to my writing group and they all said, got no idea what's going on here. This is all just so complicated. And I realised it just was too complicated. So, yeah.
God bless the writing group.
Yes.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for your time today. I've really enjoyed our chat, and mazel tov for the novel. another beautiful piece of work.
Thank you very much. It's been a great chat. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2023 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find interviews with many a luminary. Subscribe to the podcast series to be notified when new episodes drop. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's hip and happening in historical fiction. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.